I want to welcome all of you to today's Chamber of Commerce and Carroll County Growth Partnership Legislative Forum. We certainly want to thank our Senator Jason Schultz and our State Representative Brian Best for being here today. We want to thank all of you for joining us. I want to let you know that we at St. Anthony are very thankful that we are able to host. We're thankful that all of you are joining us. My name is Trish Roberts. I do serve on the Legislative Committee for the Chamber, and I'd like those of you in the room who serve on the committee, if you just raise your hand. So we've got a number here who serve. So thank you to those who meet ahead of time and work on the committee and plan these events. I also want to recognize Matt Miners. He keeps us organized. And I want today to thank Don Bernholtz, just finding his seat here. Don organized our flag display, and so we appreciate that. Let's give Don. So today, we are going to begin with opening statements from our senator and our state representative, and then we have several prepared questions, and then we are going to open up the forum to questions from our audience. And so, I'm going to let you guys decide who goes first, and we're going to give you 5 minutes each for your opening statements. So, yes.
Good morning, everyone. Maybe I should stand.
Go ahead. Yes.
This is our first one of the year here in Carroll County, so feels like we probably should have had it before. We tried to, but it didn't work out with the weather. So. I'm Brian Best, I'm your state representative. I'm on my ninth year at the State House. And the committees that I serve on are HHS, which is Health and Human Services, used to be called Human Resources, but they changed the name this year. I serve on Commerce, Labor. I serve on the RIF Budget Committee. The RIF Budget is the Reinforced Iowa's Infrastructure Committee, which is most of that money comes from the casino gambling, and it goes into a big pot. Money that is distributed to a lot of that goes to the buildings and the infrastructure of Iowa, so like public buildings, things like that. The capital itself would be operated into the budget as well. And also, I serve as a transportation chair in the House. And it asks for the question is what are our priorities for the year? Obviously, many of the governor's priorities have already been acted on and have been passed. One priority that I have that has to do with transportation is we've been trying to get hands-free through for a number of years. Still haven't done it. The hands-free driving where you can't have a phone in your hand when you're driving. The distractions from that have cost many lives. I think there's no doubt that we've lost lives in Iowa because of that. So I'm still trying to get that passed. I think it's got a clearer path in the Senate than it does in the House. It's going to be a struggle to get it passed, but I'm still working on that. That's very important to me. Now, one thing I want to mention during my 5 minutes here is that this marks the 50th anniversary of U.S. combat troops returning home from the Vietnam War. This date is now known as the National Vietnam War Veterans Day. And so I just want to kind of shout out. Obviously, when as most of us recall, when the Vietnam War was going on, the veterans were treated pretty poorly. Folks coming back were treated miserably. And I think we need to recognize that. And at the state level, if there's something we need to do to recognize the Vietnam veterans, I really would like to do that. So I just wanted to put that in there, too. So that being said, also, there's been some discussion about what they call drugs that would cause abortions or abortion drugs. And I know that's something they're working on at the legislature right now. There's some laws being drawn up on that issue, too. And so I've got my ears open. I know I've been receiving a lot of emails on this issue, and probably 100, I'm going to say, which is quite a few. And so that's something that I'm very interested in seeing what we can do about that too. That's for the getting here. And that's really all I have to say at this time. So I'll let Jason get it all out.
Well, welcome, folks. This will be my first official forum here. I'm with a lot of positive, nervous energy. I look forward to talking to new people, hearing new personalities, and all of that. So I'm a small farmer over in Crawford County. I've been in the Senate for 8 years. I was in the House for 6 years before that, where I learned the lessons that really benefited me in the Senate. So things have gone well the last 8 years, which lead me to what I'm getting done in the Senate. I'm currently on, I'm the chair of state government. I'm also on the Commerce Committee, which I chaired the last couple of years. Also on Ways and Means, which will have some issues come up today. Workforce, which used to be the old labor. We have a major bill going through there. And I've been asking for these committees because they have relevant issues to Western Iowa and to the state as a whole for years. So I'm very glad to be there and working on those. So this session has been a touch different. Quite often, like a plane taking off, you start slow on the runway and you build up speed and then you head up. This one seemed to be a rocket that shot straight up because we started with school choice, one of the more controversial issues immediately. While that was happening, I was actually preparing for what the issue, the contentious issue that would happen right after that, which was medical malpractice liability reform, tort reform. Been an issue for 30 or 40 years, rising all the way to the federal level. So we started off with a rocket, took up there, we moved on to Med-Mal. We did get that done. Very, very happy for the effects that's going to have on rural Iowa for both protecting our hospitals and recruiting, retention, and protection of our doctors. One of the issues that happens quite a bit, I know it happens here because I've heard it happens here, but when you get closer over to the river where I live, I start talking to folks from Sioux City and Council Bluffs, and they simply can't get professionals to come across the river because either the employer, the healthcare system, or the physician or specialist themselves can't afford the liability insurance to come over and practice in Iowa. So we ended up, actually had, and since he said it on the floor publicly, Tom Shipley, our senator and colleague, had a health crisis, was ambulanced to Council Bluffs. They diagnosed, identified the treatment he needed, and that healthcare system actually put him back in a hospital, or back in an ambulance, to go across the river to the specialist in the same system, instead of just getting that man in the car to drive over and take care of him. And that was entirely due to our tort environment in Iowa. They couldn't afford to keep him if he or they hadn't paid for the liability insurance. In Nebraska, it's simply a workable system. We hope going forward it's going to be a workable system here. The experience in many, many other states that have done this, including almost every state around us, shows that it is a beneficial impact. So I'm looking forward to that. Once that was done, I started focusing then on running the governor's alignment bill, which in short will move the governor's cabinet, which is not a phrase that I've heard a whole lot over my time in the legislature. I just don't, you hear about presidents and cabinets. I didn't realize that so often the governor would meet with those who report directly to her, and she had 37 of them. And that's an unworkable, anybody who works human resources or flow charts or anything, realize one executive can't manage 37 direct report employees. She's worked up a system using a consultant, using other state models to move us to 15. And yet you're going to have, definitely, when you have humans looking at changes in the flowchart, you're going to have, I totally understand them and don't blame them, have people worried about how this will affect either their services or their careers or kingdoms. That's just the way things go. We've identified two of them so far, and I was actually on the phone with somebody talking about that. That's why I walked in right at the minute. I'm sorry, I meant to get here 15 minutes early. But those two items, just so you know, and then we can talk about it more, would be community-based corrections. The flowchart, the bill would move them under corrections, under the Department of Corrections, under Director Beth Skinner. And they have concerns about the loss of individual action and counter opinion to corrections, whose job is to incarcerate people and then decide when they get out of prison, but they have to go somewhere. Well, due to overcrowding overcrowding, they have a pressure to get people out of prison, and they're trying to select the safest, the most predictably recovered. But it is community-based corrections that takes them, finds halfway homes, tries to find jobs, and monitors them, both through probation and parole. So I was talking to somebody involved in that. The other item would be ICAP, the Iowa Child Advocacy Board. That is the Foster Care Review Board and the CASA, Court-Appointed Special Advocates. They also, they're currently under DIA, Inspections and Appeals, and the bill would move them under Health and Human Services, the new name for DHS. And there's similar concerns about the loss of independence of action and whether the goals and mission conflict. So we're looking at these. I think the governor has put together a pretty good program. The bill itself is 1,600 pages long. Most of it technical, you know, either repeals, renaming, references to other chapters of code. So I'm running the bill. I scheduled 8 hours of subcommittee, and I'm interested in you hearing this too, because you're Jane Bloomingdale's going through the state government. We scheduled 8 hours of subcommittee and actually finished early every two-hour block that I set up, because we'd put on the agendas the divisions that we were going over, which departments we were going to talk about. And to the governor's credit, they put together a bill so well thought out, the homework was done so well, that the governor would have, and her staff would present the divisions and the reasons for it. The department heads affected would be there at the table to receive questions from the public at large. Lobbyists, the public would want to be there. And we only identified five issues. Three of them I think we're going to work through. We've got two that I've mentioned already. But we finished almost in less than half the time on a few, because everything had been thought out, problems had been considered and handled, and nobody asked any questions. So we said, well, I guess we'll all move on with our day. I thought that was pretty good. I mean, for a 1,600-page bill, they did their homework, they provided a nearly finished project, and then they're asking the legislature to take a look at it. Once we get through that, there's always going to be issues that pop up. So I look forward to coming in a month, and some of this will be in our rear view mirror, and then we'll have new issues to talk about. But we're really actually looking at somewhat of a clean road out of Des Moines, is the way we put it. Quite often, when we start slow and build up, the large issues end up becoming negotiating points when we do the budget. And who's going to take care of, you know, so what policy provisions in these large bills are going to fall the House opinion or to the Senate's position? And that's not necessarily the greatest way to run policy, or to run budget bills. I mean, you should be focused on the effect of budgets and numbers and dollar signs. So now we have these out of the way. And that's why we're friends, and yet each chamber has a different position that each caucus has to represent. So I'm interested in getting to a clear road to the budget process, which leads out of town, where our chambers are negotiating dollar signs and its effect on Iowa, as opposed to policy within budget bills or in exchange for budget bills. So I kind of like this system. It doesn't happen very often, but it did this year, so I can't wait to see how it turns up and report back in maybe a couple months about that. So with that, I'm trying to think of anything else huge going on. We've got the youth employment bill, we've got property tax implications, we have I filed a gender balance repeal that I guess I'd like to talk about for just a second. Going back decades, there was an effort when the Democrats had a trifecta to place gender balance in everything and just from the state level put guidelines on who can be where. If that was ever needed, I think we're past that point now, and there's a list of reasons I could go into. But I actually filed a bill to remove the gender balance requirements on local and state boards. The governor's behind it and said, actually, we'd like to expand a little more to catch three boards that I didn't have. The reason is the governor has to appoint probably about 300 people, I think, each year to various boards, and to add additional guidelines for they have to be one party or the other, they have to be in this occupation, then you add gender in there, when that's not a problem going forward. The governor and her staff are predominantly female, to be quite honest. And they don't have a problem. They just said, no, we just need to put the best people on there. We have multiple experiences where good people are volunteering, and I'm like, well, I'm sorry, you're not the right gender. So we're trying to do that. That was an interesting personal experience because I didn't know what the backlash would be. So I actually filed it under my name, not telling anybody, because if I stepped on a landmine, I wanted to be the only one hurt. I believe in the team, and I like the Republican team, or the Senate Republicans, the House Republicans, and the governor. I wanted it to just be me. Turns out all the feedback was, my goodness, finally somebody's doing this. And so I think I can go public with the governor's mind, and I hope the House is interested in this. It's just a good government. So anyway, with that, I'm interested to hear questions, and I think that's about it. Thanks for coming in.
All right, so we have several prepared questions from the Legislative Committee, and then we will open it up to questions from our audience today. So first we're going to start with a question related to taxing. And the first question is this. Senate Study Bill 1124 would put a cap on increased levies at 2.5% for local taxing authorities. This can make it difficult for cities, counties, and school districts to finish their budgets, especially during a time of high inflation. Do you believe this is the best way for the state to lower property tax values? Is it appropriate for the state to take this authority over and control what the levy increases can be? And I'll let you decide who will answer that first.
It's a Senate study bill, so I will. So I'm on Ways and Means. Dan Dawson wrote this up. And it is trying to get control of the property tax system. I guess I'll start as an introductory. The cities and counties are subdivisions of the state. The state, all property tax is placed in Iowa code. How it works, and it is for the legislature to put in and to change. I believe the authority is valid. And part of the big picture. I mean, so we're addressing income tax, you've seen them drop quite a bit, and we're hoping to get to a point where Iowa becomes a no income tax state. We are broadening the sales tax environment. We've got so many exemptions in there that are just political handouts. So we're broadening that out to make up for income tax. And then there is always the understanding that's been proved valid. When you lower income taxes, the economy supercharges and you start getting more business activity and revenue. That's happened as well. One of the things that we've identified while we're letting those changes work out, constituents have endlessly reached out to the legislature and say that we can't afford our property anymore. They own them, they've paid off their mortgage. Some people are on fixed incomes, Social Security, they're retired, they don't have an opportunity to get a job, a different job, or anything, and they said, I'm gonna have to sell my house simply because the property taxes keep going up. So we have tried twice to reform property tax. And the lesson that I got there and the warning that I still carry forward is that if you don't have buy-in from local officials, there are so many ways to go around the legislature's intent. This bill is a little different. There are no cuts to anybody's budgets. What it does is try to put a formula and a framework in place to regulate growth of budgets, and that we think we can do. Now, the question, actually, when I was reading through these, talks about lowering value assessments, I think, and the bill doesn't do that. The assessors out there, if there's a mechanism there, that's not the main deal. So I just think that's a semantic thing. But there is a formula that allows, I think 2.5% was mentioned. I thought it was 2.5% till I went to Dan with the concerns I was hearing from back home. And he said, no, it's on average actually 3.25%. And the formula actually allows some counties who have either growth or very low cash balances or other things to actually grow. And there's one city out there they've identified could actually grow 8 to 9%. I mean, so it's not a hard and fast, you can't grow. One of the thoughts that I've had after going through two property tax reforms, multiple income tax cuts, and then sales tax conversations is that I've always said over all the years, I am always going to stand up for the taxpayer. I mean, that's part of the reason I got into office. I'm going to be for the taxpayer. And I thought, and I'm not throwing any accusations out there, and I want to build relationships, not break them down, but I thought that every Republican office holder also was doing that. And so I'm a little uncomfortable and not totally sure how to respond when Republican office holders are arguing for additional spending as opposed to reductions in spending and efficiencies and letting people keep their money. I'm working my way through that myself. But I'm not trying to say that it is a dead letter in the Senate, that it can't go anywhere, but I am going to say that it is somewhat a negotiating position, because without a doubt, you folks have your own property tax bill. We're going to have to merge them together. And some of the positions are, although I'm putting my name on them and voting them out of committee, and I probably will off the floor if we go that far, they are strong positions. There's no doubt about that. But at the same time, I'm fighting for the taxpayer. And what I said in Harlan at our forum last week was, when constituents in the same number that are currently telling me that property taxes are killing them, when the same number of constituents flip around and say that we need more services and I want to pay more property taxes, I'll probably tell you folks that you need to find a new senator, to be quite honest, because it's not in my nature. So I'm going to be bluntly honest there. But it will be time. If we get to the point where people are begging to pay more taxes for more services, the climate will have changed to the point where there will need to be people to manage that situation. So with that, I'll let Brian.
Comments?
One thing that we've been talking about in the House is the possibility of, instead of limiting the growth to that 3.25, is to maybe limit assessed values to that number, which would in its own way probably help, at least your assessments aren't going to climb ridiculously high. So that's another option that might be available, and the House is talking about that. One thing that I hope, as a legislature, we do have to keep in mind one thing with all this that's going on, is that the supervisors, the mayors, the city councils, they're all elected officials, so I think we do have to be wary about taking over too much control where local control is good. I had a supervisor who mentioned that in a different county that they had over the past number of years stated about 2.5% growth, but they liked the fact that they could go over that growth some years and be under that amount of growth in other years, which over a 10-year period it leveled out. But they did have some years where they were over 2.5%. But it all kind of came out in the wash over a 10-year period, so I think we have to be mindful that there are going to be years where maybe a county has to go over that 2.5 for various reasons. So we'll see where it comes out. I'm on Ways and Means in the House side. Jason's on Ways and Means in the Senate side. There'll be a lot of negotiating that'll be going on for sure.
Thank you. So the next question relates to Medicaid. Here's the question. Many hospitals, nursing homes, mental health units, and other facilities, specifically like New Hope Village, that serve individuals who are on Medicaid, are not reimbursed at a level that comes close to covering the costs. Around Iowa, there are 28 nursing homes that have already closed and 24 Iowa hospitals that are at serious risk of closing. Do you have any insight, or would you agree to increase Medicaid reimbursement?
Okay.
I think that we're still woefully behind what we have to do, and we have New Hope Village in this area. I know the struggles that they have in trying to keep employees there. There's other places where their professionals can go and probably make more money. So I think as a state, we have to be competitive. We're losing psychiatrists and psychology type professionals too to other states because of our Medicaid reimbursement being so low. And that's a big part of that crowd of folks who are needing those services are Medicaid patients. And so I would be for anything that we can do to enhance our ability to keep those professionals in those places where we need them. And I mentioned New Hope Village because that's probably the obvious one for this area. And so I know what a struggle they have, and I'm looking for anything we can do to help them to retain their professionals.
And this is a personal question. I'll confess right up front. My number one constituent, Amy, my wife, is the administrator at Gracewell over there in Dennis. So when I hear from her and she updates me, whenever they find out within the industry the more nursing homes are going under or announced closure, I find out typically even before the public because her nursing home association put that out before it was announced. I have met, so I'm going to say yes. I mean, I want to answer the question. Yes, I can support it. However, it has to fit within a budget that allows Iowa to grow. The magic sauce that we've found in the last, well, since 2017 is when you allow the private sector to grow faster than public spending, the economy supercharges again, and you end up with more revenues just coming in. I mean, that's how, and the taxes are going down. So that is the environment that allows us to actually cover more Medicaid in there. So I'm going to continue supporting the environment that allows revenues to go up so that we can afford the expenses. But yes, I do. I will say publicly and on camera here, we have a nursing home crisis right now. We also have somewhat, but to a lesser extent, a hospital crisis with Medicaid. But nursing homes right now, given the amount of closures, I am afraid we're going to have a crisis where families are driving well over an hour to go see immediate family if we don't do something. Now, so I've looked into this, and here's the report on action then. I've met with the governor's liaison who came to talk to me about other issues, and I asked him, my wife sent in, so I made sure my wife had direct access to the governor's staff, and then after that went in and visited with the governor herself and the liaison so that we could talk about this. What I found out there is we also, our governor's very good, does her homework, she was prepared. We have a demographic change happening right now. So it's not just a dollar situation. We have the largest generation in American history, the baby boomers. They started retiring long ago, and they're passing on. We actually have an infrastructure of nursing homes built in preparation of the largest generation needing them. And as they pass on, the next generation is not as large, and we actually have, although there is a need that we feel, the numbers are not there to fill them up. Part of the problem that we're running into is twofold. First of all, there are people to currently fill our nursing homes, but we don't have the staff. So we have a problem. I can tell you Gracewell right now, my wife would say it publicly. They have six people waiting to go into Gracewell, but they do not have the staff to legally serve them. And actually, I might want to change that. My wife said actually they could take them. They're under the ratio, but they are afraid of Department of Inspections and Appeals finding deficiencies because there's not enough people to cross every I and dot every T. So they're afraid to take these people. Now, census matters. Most of these business models were set up on 90, 95, 100% occupancy. They're not there. Gracewell, actually, they built a brand new nursing home in Denison and cut the number of beds by a third. I might be a little low on that, but it was substantial. They still aren't full. They can't take them, even though they've got the beds. So we have that problem going on. But we also have an issue. Some of these nursing homes, and I've looked into it, verified it, are in areas that don't have enough people to get to them. So it's a very complicated matter. Once again, spending public money is not always it sounds like the easy first answer, but if you look into it deeper, there's other policy issues that we have to deal with. And along with Medicaid spending, which I do believe is a problem, we have other things we have to deal with. So.
Thank you, and it's not my role to be asking questions personally. However, I will say that the mental health conversation needs to be addressed as well, which mm-hmm. we as a hospital that serves the mental health population, we will continue that conversation. Thank you. One more question related to taxes, and then we're going to open this up to the public. Senate Study Bill 1125 will enact the I Will by taking some of the local option or local sales taxes to do so.
At the same time, the state will take over the local option sales tax and backfill to local communities that had a local option sales tax in place. If the state is going to backfill local option sales taxes, then why even take them in the first place? Or is this something the state will eventually stop backfilling and keep the funds for themselves?
And my turn to go first. And this is a Senate Ways and Means proposal. So there's multiple components to this. Number one, the people of Iowa voted for the constitutional amendment, and to be quite honest, I wish they hadn't. I don't know that it's good policy to have the entire state vote, but it did give us a good message as to how important outdoor recreation is, clean water, environmental stewardship. So the message is certainly there, but it's caused a difficulty and a conflict in a state that didn't want to raise their sales tax even at the time. So it requires an increase of the state sales tax, of which one-third will go to IWIL. That formula is in Iowa code. So we've been trying to figure out a way to satisfy the people's desire to have the amendment fulfilled with a good policy manner that doesn't make life more difficult in Iowa. The mechanism that was come up was to, the simple way is to take that local option sales tax, move it from the counties, reduce the sales tax, and put the lost penny back on the sales tax, which triggers the amendment, and then send all that money back out to the cities the way they were receiving it. So nobody would notice a change. That's the intent. The backfill question is legitimate, but goes back several years to among some of our property tax reforms. That was when we had a split legislature, and there is still argument on the floor of the Senate as to whether there was a promise to backfill or not. I was in the House at the time, supported the property tax reform. We had no intention that there was going to be a permanent backfill and that it was going to always be a transition to when property assessments came up and property taxes naturally grew, which has already been talked about here, so we know it happens, that once everybody was made whole, the whole system would, the transition backfill would go away. Senate Democrats, who were the majority then, said openly that this is a promise forever and it will be a shift of taxation from the property to the sales tax and income tax, and we mean for it to be forever. Well, you can imagine the folks who received that, they would like to have it go on forever, and yet that was never my intent as a House member or the House Republicans. So that is the history of the backfill question. This one, it would be intentional and it would be in code that it is a permanent backfill, and that any effort to change that would be a difficult and unlikely to succeed vote, because it would be an outright legislative breaking of the promise. So I told Farm Bureau, including Carol Shelby Crawford at Manning at the shelter house, I didn't think this issue was even going to come up. It did come up. I'm still not convinced it's going to go anywhere. I am interested in the House version or House opinion and what your insight is. It exists. It should be talked about. This isn't one of the things I predicted to come up, and I don't know that there's a whole lot of momentum.
Yeah, there isn't a whole lot of momentum in the House. I can tell you that some of us are a little bit wary. The point made there is a good point. We've had a history of doing this, so we want to make sure we can make this system work. But the question is, I think, in a lot of people's mind, is how do you make the cities and counties whole while you take the 3/8 and they get all that money back, but then how are you not raising taxes? So if there's a way to do it, I think it's worth the conversation, but I don't think we're there yet. And I agree that it's probably quite likely the bill probably won't go very far in the House at all. So.
All right. It's all up to you guys now. So we're going to open this up to questions, and I will call on you. Please raise your hand. When I call on you, I'd like you to state your name, and if you're with an organization, state clearly who you are with, and state your question. So, yes.
I'm Sue Galing. I'm a psychiatric nurse practitioner from here in the Carroll area. I am with Classroom Clinic, which is a school-based telehealth business with school districts access to children's mental health services using telehealth. So Senator Schultz, Representative Best, thank you for both being here today. In your opening statements, Representative Best, you said that most of the governor's priorities have already been acted upon. However, children's mental health is one of the top priorities of the governor. And unfortunately, that crisis is only getting worse. So there's more work that can be done, some of which are very simple bipartisan actions. For example, schools in Iowa currently are allowed to bill Medicaid for services, but they're only allowed to bill for those Medicaid-eligible students that have an IEP or are in special ed services. Most school districts have between a 12 and 15% special ed rate, so that leaves a large chunk of students that the schools are providing services to that schools are unable to bill Medicaid for and pull down that additional revenue. Iowa schools could actually be billing Medicaid for all services provided to Medicaid-eligible students, regardless of whether or not they're in special ed, but it requires state action. Senator Schultz, you mentioned policy issues related to Medicaid that need to be addressed, and I'm glad you brought that up, because an example that you can work on is in a federal pre-care rule that was reversed in 2014. The pre-care rule is a policy that was reversed that allows states to actually enable school districts to bill Medicaid for all Medicaid-eligible students and not restrict it for those students that have special ed. Unfortunately, that pre-care rule was reversed in 2014, and Iowa is one of the states that has not taken any action at all yet, even though both of you have been in office that entire time. So if action were taken in Iowa, it would require either a state plan amendment for the Medicaid plan or perhaps just language that clarifies this issue and would then allow schools to bill Medicaid for all Medicaid-eligible students. That would pull down Medicaid dollars into a separate revenue stream into the local school district that schools could then reinvest and specifically use for student mental health services. They could use that revenue to contract with outside community-based organizations or actually hire staff and provide those school mental health services themselves. So unfortunately, there's been no action yet. And I've met with Representative Joel Fry and Ann Meyer on the House side, but we're having struggles on the Senate side being able to get attention to this issue. This is a bipartisan, simple issue. If we can bring down Medicaid dollars, it would actually help reduce state dollars and property tax dollars that are utilized by school districts. So both Senator Schultz and Representative Best, if you could speak to this issue and perhaps pledge that you will take some action and make a difference for this children here in Iowa.
Well, if there's no better action, I'll start.
Please do.
I've never heard of this. I've never been on Human Services. I'm interested to get your name and contact number so I can give it to Jeff Edlund. Now, what perked my ears up, first question I had is it impossible to, and this is an ugly statement on how life really works versus policy, is it impossible to just kind of pencil whip a night individual education program for the kids so that we can't do that? Okay. Let me just make an IEP so that they're eligible.
No.
There's real world and there's policy. I know there's a whole lot of corner around here in a whole lot of areas. So, number two, it got changed in 14?
2014, CMS, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid, changed that federal policy. 17 other states in the country have already taken action at the state level. Iowa's not one of them. There are plenty of red states that have taken action besides blue states. And those states are now able to pull down tens of millions of federal Medicaid money to the local school district that can then be reinvested for specifically health services or mental health services and supports. It would not go into the special education budget, so it could be used for mental health. But Iowa has not taken any action at all. When I visited with Representative Fry and Ann Meyer, they had their Republican caucus staff look into that. And essentially, the Department of Education is pointing fingers at the state Medicaid office, and the state Medicaid office is pointing fingers at the Department of Education. Why can't these state agencies work together and address this?
That's my takeaway. So I need your contact information and I can talk to you.
And I think we've got a really good point. It's a really big issue.
It is.
Could I ask that in order to allow other questions and more discussion that we following, we make sure that we have contact information.
Because this seems doable.
It's.
I mean, if you just need broken through the bureaucracy, then that's what we're supposed to do.
Thank you. We'll make sure that we'll get contact information.
I don't have policy objections to it. Yeah. I mean, that sounds like something we ought to be looking.
Thank you. Next question.
My name is Jeff Kaler. I'm currently serving as the interim city manager for Carroll. With the Senate Study Bill 1124, which is now Senate File 356, I believe, as I read the bill, it sounds like that limitation on growth of 2.5% or 3.25% also doesn't allow cities to realize growth from new development. The last few years, our city has done a number of things to try to encourage construction of new buildings and rehab of existing in order to increase our housing stock and things like that. But as I read this bill, it sounds like if that type of development pushed us over those caps, we wouldn't be able to realize that. And as a result, we don't have the funding to provide infrastructure and response by police, fire, whatever. Is there a reason, a good reason, that they would exclude new growth or new development? I get the existing properties, but the new stuff I don't get.
I'm gonna have to look into that. I don't have a pat answer for that.
Okay.
So you brought up something that I'll look into.
I mean, because really it seems like a disincentive to cities and counties as far as doing things like we're doing in the way of tax abatement, or we're doing an infill housing incentive. It would seem to disincentivize that type of activity because you can't benefit from the new growth.
Yes, I will look into that.
Thank you.
That's the point that's really good.
Thank you. Question.
Good morning, Marty Helbert. I used to retire now after working 46 years seeing patients. I guess my title now is I work with my wife. I go far. I want to thank you, Senator Schultz and Representative Betts, for coming out, bringing the state government out. These are what I call a government 101 class. I have 2 points I want to mention to you. I want to thank you for the tort reform. I'm state president 15, 20 years ago. We were working on that then. It's good to see now. Something you don't realize with that, it's going to make it easier for me to stay in the state now. But I still have to pay a tail, even though I retired 3 years ago, which is pretty expensive staying in Iowa. I want to stay here with my kids and grandkids, so thank you for doing that. And the issue you hear every year is this Medicaid reimbursement. When I stopped, you were at 44% of UCR. That's way below cost. I've taken in 4 young associates. They said, no, you can't leave. We don't want to take your Medicaid patients. It's every one of them we see, it's a loss. Well, actually, it's such a loss that it's making the rest of us that aren't on Medicaid pay more to cover that loss. I know the hospital has trouble, New Hope Village has trouble. Just get that up there to a reasonable. Thank you.
A short follow-up, and this is cruel. You're still paying then, because do you need to cover insurance for actions that, you know, for care that you provided in the past? Is that what it is?
As a provider, you have to carry a tail. It's called a tail. It isn't as expensive as the other insurance there. It's if somebody, an action I did, I retired 3 years ago, 3 years and a month ago, they come back, they can do that. Most adults, it's only 7 years, but it's up to 30 years. That I'm looking for that.
Yes, my name is Dick Searle. I'm a retired DCI agent. When I started in 1973, there was absolutely no form of gambling legal in the state of Iowa. Now we've got virtually every form of gambling you could possibly imagine. And trying to find any place that tells us how much money the state of Iowa takes in from gambling operations, either directly or indirectly, since they collect income tax as soon as a jackpot is paid out is virtually impossible. Now, you guys vote on ways and means. I'm sure you've got an approximate idea on how much comes in from sales tax, income tax, property taxes. You're dividing up this gambling money. How much is there in that pot?
Hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. And the reason it's so amorphous is you've got the county foundation money, you got the Rebuild Iowa Infrastructure Fund, you've got income tax. I mean, there's so many pots. I'm happy to go through and add the pots together and tell you.
That would be great
if you'd like to know.
An approximate number within 2 or 3 million.
It is so large, that would be a pretty close to precise number.
That's what I'm getting at. Is the only thing I know the state advertises for people to use the lottery because the state's making money hand over fist though. It's not really a transparency. Besides the fact that the people least able to pay that form of taxation are the ones that pay the most of it. Very few millionaires in Iowa go to Casey's and buy lottery tickets. But you see people there that can't afford to feed their kids buying $20 worth of tickets a week. I have a problem with that. I really do.
Well, I know in the RIF budget, I believe it's $130 million, something like that, under RIF alone, that the actual lottery, I couldn't tell you those numbers, so that's something that we do need to work with. But the RIF comes from casinos alone.
But it's, like you said, it's divided up into so many pieces that trying to find out how much there really is virtually impossible.
But I can. The liaison at Revenue, Carol Wilson, could probably put together. I'm sure they have a spreadsheet of some sort. But I would go straight
I'll
to Revenue.
Name and address and phone number. If you get that report, I'd love to have it. Do you have anything else?
So as the new state government chair, you go and you meet meet folks before a session, and you can imagine the gambling interests. We're front and center making appointments. I told them I'm not a friend of gambling. I'm not going to expand gambling in any form or manner. And yet we don't have the votes to remove gambling. And many people here maybe like it. So we're going to govern gambling. Oh, there won't be any expansions. They've asked for more cell phone games and more all that. I've said we're not going to do that. So the gambling you have now is probably going to sit that way.
There was just an article a week or so ago about the administrator from Curry Meadows. His bonus last year was over $1 million, and it more than doubled his paycheck for the year. Now, if they can afford to pay that kind of money, you know, somebody's, you know, getting left out here.
Wow. But that's why I hate gambling.
Okay, so moving on, and good point, thank you. Moving on, I am going to take the liberty. We did have an emailed question. I'm going to identify the person as we identify all questions. Mary Bruner was unable to attend, and she emailed a question regarding SNAP. Mary is a local resident. SNAP is a federal program that feeds the poor and hungry in our state. The state of Iowa is responsible for administering the program. The cost of administering the program, as I have researched, has not increased in the last 12 years. The legislature is proposing to put an asset test in place for those who receive SNAP benefits. And just to condense, could you discuss any changes that are happening in each of your caucuses about changes to the SNAP program?
I think there's been some misunderstandings about what it would limit. There for a while, people were saying that it was going to limit meats, things like that, proteins. That's not the case. All the SNAP would do in the house is not allow for sugary drinks and candy, which I think most people would say that's okay to take those out. As far as the meats testing is concerned, I'm not going to say exactly what that's going to be, because that has not been determined yet. I think that bill's going to come up within the next week or two, and there's a lot of changes being made to it right now, a lot of amendments. So as far as the means testing, there probably will be some means testing, but I don't believe it's going to be unrealistic.
The welfare reform is the umbrella term we've used for years. I've been working on welfare reform ever since we got the charge back in 2017. None of my efforts have been focused toward what you can buy. And when the headlines popped on the House bill, I had dealt with the lobby on welfare reform during subcommittee to know that, holy cow, somebody got an inkling of an idea, and they turned it into the biggest dramatic opposition they could, because that's what happened to me too when we were trying. So my efforts have always been focused on getting the most efficient means to check the assets and eligibility of those who are applying. So right now we have 400 case management workers who are going through manually to accepting paper or electronic applications, going through, if they come up with a question on the application, they have to mail or email the applicant, set that case aside, go back to another ward and work on it. They have to close or approve or deny. They have to close 12 files a day per person on average. I did a little bit of research, and we have what are called federally regulated credit bureaus, and that would be Equifax, LexisNexis, Experian, there's four or five of them, and they have access to everything. They're the people who make our debit cards, credit cards, bank loans, everything work. They already know everything about you, and that bothers a lot of people, but I'm afraid there's nothing I can do about it, is what I learned. I wanted to try and put out a request for proposal to those folks. Could you take our Medicaid list, our public benefits list, run it through your databases and find out who lives here, who doesn't live here, who's not eligible according to the federal requirements? And then Iowa does allow things that the federal, you can be more generous, you can't be less generous. But who actually has a need for this? It's been a tremendous fight. I don't have it done yet. We did, but none of it ever addressed what they could buy. And you guys can do that, that's all fine, and I know your heart's all in the right spot, and that the accusations aren't true. I knew that from the beginning. But we're trying to do this. Eventually, and I was fighting with Human Services, this year Human Services is trying a pilot program with Equifax to actually see how our computers will match up. I know they'll match up fine, and we did that research already, to see how it would work for a trial basis. And so my nervousness, actually, and this is where it's good for you and I to be here together and talk about it, my nervousness is that actually any effort at welfare reform in those areas could interfere or impact the pilot program that I'm hoping to get huge successful results from. Because then what's happening, and I started this before the pandemic, but the pandemic had the federal government expand Medicaid, and you can't take anybody off, even if their conditions change, during the national emergency. Well, tens of thousands of Iowans are on there who are not going to be eligible once they pull the trigger, change the policy. We need a way better than 400 manually inspecting state workers. We need a way to run them through a database. The database, and I'd like to point out, the database doesn't kick them off the program. It gives those 400 case management workers, these are your flagged files, look at them first, and then quit looking for a needle in a haystack. I think it's good policy, and I'm hoping we can get a final product.
Very good.
I've been looking forward to it too. So
I don't know if you want to say that. Stephanie Houseman, Carroll County Supervisor. Thank you guys for being here, and thank you for your service. I don't really have a question, but continue to be mindful and cognizant of local boards and government. Lately, we've kind of had our legs cut off underneath us, and we have to get through our budget, which is gonna be difficult. I know you guys can say it's gonna, from a mistake not made on our own. And I think there's different ways that could have been handled. That's my opinion. But just going forward, please be very cognizant of your constituents and decisions you guys make down in Des Moines, what impact, and have that open communication with us and the city council, because I think Gene will also say with me, this year is going to be a very interesting budget year just because of the mistakes that have been made. So that's it.
Yes, sir.
Gene Miners.
Gene Miners, Carroll County Supervisor.
Let's please remember home rule. Where the rubber meets the road. We have a better understanding of what's going on locally than what you can. That's all I have. Remember home rule. And you know, you talk about backfields. Been around enough history. Remember back in the 80s, we were called a bank franchise tax that the cities and the counties got. That got pulled from us. It was never meant for the state. We never got it back. Those are the memories we have.
I think we have time for one more question. Yes, sir.
My name is Tony Hooper, and I am a public school teacher. I'm only here representing myself. But I have a question about the ESA bill. Actually, a couple questions. I'll try to be brief. Basically, in 3 years when this is fully phased in, and the estimates that I've read say it could cost the state $345 million a year. Although I believe in the fast track process that actually subverted the Ways and Means Committee, if I'm not mistaken. How are we going to pay for that? If we're talking about lowering taxes, but this is new money that is not a transfer of money from the public schools, which in my opinion is bad enough, but where is that money going to come from? And my second question is, we've already removed the testing requirement that was part of the original deal to assess the viability of people that were transferring from public schools to private schools. Why is that a good idea? And if we're all going to receive state money, should we not all be on the same playing field? Should private schools not have to publish their test scores and assessments so that we have an honest comparison of private schools to public schools? Because right at the moment, that doesn't exist.
Thank you for bringing up, because I was looking forward to this actually last month. So I voted for the Educational Assist Scholarship Program account program because I do believe it is in the best policy of the state that every child who goes to an accredited school has the state tax dollars backing them. I've thought that for a long, long time. To address yours specifically, so the testing requirement, I've got to confess in front of everybody, I'm not totally sure I know about that, but that wouldn't have changed my vote. I still believe the money should follow the student. I guess I'm interested.
Can I clarify?
Would you please?
I mean, if I'm not mistaken, in the original bill, anybody, at least in the first couple of years, that is coming from a public school to a private school was still supposed to be subject to taking any assessments they would have taken at the public school, so that there was a measuring stick to see if there was actually academic progress being made once they switched. But 3 weeks after the bill was passed, then an addendum was passed that removed that testing requirement. And so now that is gone. I mean, they're only subject to whatever tests they would be subject to at the private school, which are only required by their accreditation agency.
Okay. And that puts a little more clarity. There's going to be ongoing, in fact, I'm wondering if by the end of this session, there are not going to be some requirements. Another complaint is that private schools can turn down applicants.
Yeah.
By the end of the session, and this is not a promise, this is what's being talked about off the microphone, a consideration that schools would not be able to deny an applicant based only on an IEP. That if that's your, you know, that there has to be a, you got to be full or something. And private schools have access to some ADEA services anyway, so I think that's all fair to do. There's going to be an ongoing equalization between schools in the coming years. I mean, the sentiment is there, and it's going to be based on reducing requirements on public schools to bring you down. And that I can't make as a promise, but I can tell you the sentiment is there because we've been actually trying to get this done, several of us, I'm one of them, to just get it down there. I wanted to do it in preparation for ESAs. And then the way it turned out, it happened, ESAs happened first. But there is still the sentiment among many of us that, well, let's lower the overhead and requirements on public schools. Because if you want competition, you want as close to a level playing field, while still having the advantages of each. And public schools have advantages that privates don't, privates have some of the public schools.
Okay, let's give Representative Best a chance to respond.
You probably were, I voted against the bill. I had some of the same reservations, let's say, that you did, that you do. My concern is, and I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but totally respecting Kemper and private schools, my concern is that someday they may have to operate more like a public school than what they do now. And I don't think anybody wants that. I don't think Kemper wants that. I don't want that. But as a government, as you receive money from the government, oftentimes government will expect more in return. And so I'm just hoping that this doesn't become a problem. I'm not here to criticize Jason, because Jason he's been a proponent of this for a long time. I came out quite a few years ago when this first came up and said that I just felt like public money needed to be for public schools. And I just see some possible issues in there. And so that's all I'm going to say about it. I just will always remain with that in mind. So.
Well, we're actually, can we save the question and you can visit with the legislature? We're past our time, but I just want to thank our legislators for being here. We've got a couple minutes over. I know that they will stay. Thank you, Representative Best, Senator Schultz. Thank you to all of you for being here. I think it's wonderful that we live in a community, in a region where we can have good conversation about things that are really important to all of us. So thank you. The next forum will be held on Saturday, March 25th, 10 o'clock a.m. It will be held in Manning at the Warren Timmerman Shelter House. So we hope we see all of you there. Thank you.